Now we'll take you back to All Things Considered.
President Trump says his desire to acquire Greenland is connected to not winning the Nobel Peace Prize last year. In a text message, Trump told Norway's prime minister that he no longer felt, quote, an obligation to think purely of peace. For Monday, January 19th, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang. This hour, how does the legacy of Hugo Chavez help inform the current moment in Venezuela? We trace the history from Chavez to Nicolas Maduro to the interim president, Delcy Rodriguez.
What we're seeing is something akin to a hostile takeover of another corporation.
Also, the first known example of a cow using tools. Her name is Veronica.
Veronica just rolled out her pink tongue. With the tip of the tongue, she grabbed like with an index finger the stick.
And how AI is changing the practice of medicine. First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. The Prime Minister of Norway says he got a message from President Trump about rising tensions over Greenland. Trump reportedly said he no longer felt obligated to pursue peace after not winning the Nobel Peace Prize. The Peace Prize is awarded by an independent committee, not the Norwegian government. Trump has now imposed a 10% tariff on goods from 8 European countries that oppose his efforts to take control of the Arctic island. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports.
Over the weekend, European nations put out a joint statement of solidarity with Denmark and Greenland and said President Trump's bellicose talk and threats to impose further tariffs on nations that object to his Greenland plans risks damaging the transatlantic alliance. Silje Bellin is head of the Paris office of the European Council on Foreign Relations.
Europe feels more alone than it's ever been, but also feels a greater sense, I think, of solidarity and collective determination to push back.
Bellin says Europeans could invoke counter-sanctions, and the EU could also activate, for the first time, an anti-coercion instrument to restrict U.S. access to the lucrative EU market. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
Hackers disrupted Iranian state TV to air footage supporting the exiled crown prince. The video urged security forces not to target civilians. It comes amid nationwide protests and a crackdown that has killed at least 3,900 people, according to human rights observers. Iran's foreign minister had his invitation to the World Economic Forum withdrawn over the killings. The Pentagon has put 1,500 soldiers on standby to possibly deploy to Minneapolis. Meanwhile, the Department of Homeland Security is facing increasing scrutiny from immigration advocates. They say the agency is trying to recruit local police officers in Minnesota and in other states. NPR's Windsor Johnston reports.
Naina Gupta is policy director with the American Immigration Council. She says police departments in Minnesota have told her organization that the DHS is trying to lure officers away from local agencies to join the federal ranks.
We know that they are looking, you know, as desperately as possible to find people to join the agency, and poaching from local police agencies is a fast way to do that, especially in the areas where they're looking to scale up immigration enforcement.
In a statement to NPR, the DHS says many of its new recruits are former law enforcement officers, military, or former ICE officers who retired or quit under the Biden administration. Windsor Johnston, NPR News.
The International Monetary Fund predicts that the world economy will shrug off President Trump's protectionist trade policies this year, thanks partly to a surge of investment in artificial intelligence. The IMF expects global growth to come in at 3.3% this year, the same as in 2025. This is NPR News. More than 100 vehicles were involved in a pileup in Michigan today as snow fueled by the Great Lakes blanketed the state. Michigan State Police closed Interstate 196 just southwest of Grand Rapids in both directions. The state police say there were many injuries, but no deaths have been reported. Scientists studying longevity are testing a combination of exercise and generic medications that help reduce inflammation in the human body. NPR's Allison Aubrey says the goal is to slow down age-related decline.
Scientists at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai will test a combination of three interventions, high-intensity interval training, as well as a supplement called spermidine, and a generic medication that has a potent anti-inflammatory effect.
As we get older, the immune system is really shifting away from good inflammation,
which is the body's acute response to fend off injury or infection. In contrast, chronic inflammation underlies the development of many diseases, everything from cancer to heart disease to dementia. Marin and his team will measure changes in inflammation. They are semi-finalists in a competition called XPRIZE HealthSpan. If results are promising, more research will follow. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
What sounds like President Trump narrating a new Fannie Mae ad is an AI-cloned voice. The ad comes as the Trump administration is making a push to make housing affordable, and the president plans to talk about housing at his appearance at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland this week. First Lady Melania Trump recently used AI to help voice the audio version of her memoir. I'm Ryland Barton. You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org.
It is 5:06, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. It's time to get rid of that old car, truck, or boat before you're stuck with it all winter. KXE's Cars program makes it quick and easy, and we'll even tow it away for free. The proceeds from your unwanted vehicle become fuel for your favorite community radio station. Visit KAXE.org/cars to get your car donation started, or call Heather at 218-326-1234 for more info.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang. President Trump said the fact that he did not win the Nobel Peace Prize is affecting his approach to pursuing Greenland. In a text released by the Prime Minister of Norway, Trump said that he no longer feels, quote, an obligation to think purely of peace, although it will always be predominant. NPR White House correspondent Daniel Kurtzleben has been covering all the back and forth over the U.S. interest in the Danish territory and joins us now. Hi, Danielle.
Hey, good afternoon.
Hey. Okay, so we know that President Trump has been getting more and more vocal about trying to acquire Greenland, but what more do we know about this whole text exchange with the Prime Minister of Norway?
Well, most of what we know about this, we've learned from the Norwegian Prime Minister himself, Jonas Gahr.
Uh-huh.
In a statement, Gahr said that he first texted Trump on behalf of himself and the President of Finland to say that they opposed some tariffs that Trump recently threatened and phone call with him. And then Trump responded saying, as you noted, that since he, Trump, didn't get the Nobel Peace Prize, he is no longer thinking, quote, purely of peace, which is itself remarkable because Trump recently attacked Venezuela and deposed its leader in order to take control of its oil. So that kind of undermines that he's always thinking of peace. Mm-hmm. But at any rate, the White House continues to insist that Trump is the president of peace and deserves the Nobel Peace Prize. Trump also ended his text message to the Norwegian Prime Minister by saying that the U.S. should control Greenland.
I mean, this is stunning because these are long-standing allyships that Trump is threatening to upend here.
Absolutely. And upend them in part because he didn't get a prize that he wanted.
Right.
Now, of course, as the Norwegian Prime Minister said in his statement, Norway does not even give the Nobel Prizes. That's an independent committee.
Mm-hmm.
And all of this comes just a few days after the latest winner of the Peace Prize, Venezuela's Maria Corina Machado, gifted her prize to Trump at the White House. The Nobel Committee, meanwhile, has said the honor is not transferable.
Okay, note to self. The tensions, though, I mean, they're obviously high. What else are we hearing from the White House on this?
Well, let's start with those tariffs I mentioned that the Norwegian Prime Minister was texting about. On Saturday, Trump posted that he is going to impose 10% tariffs on goods from 8 European countries starting February 1st, then raise that tariff to 25% in June. And Trump said he will keep those on until a deal is reached for the U.S. to acquire Greenland. Now, I've asked the White House, by the way, for any additional information. What law authorizes this? Is an executive order coming? We haven't heard anything back yet. But those 8 European countries have said that they stand in full solidarity with Denmark and Greenland, and they added that tariff threats undermine transatlantic cooperation. Now, In addition, Trump made another seemingly threatening post last night that Denmark hasn't been able to keep the Russian threat away from Greenland, and therefore, quote, now it is time and it will be done, which, of course, raises the question of what he means by that.
Exactly. OK, well, let's look ahead. I mean, Trump is, of course, heading to Europe this week for the World Economic Forum in Davos. What are we expecting there, you think?
Well, the theme of Davos this year is a spirit of dialogue, which you could see as kind of grimly funny, given all this context. But we expect Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent to speak Tuesday. Trump will speak Wednesday. We don't have a full sense of what he'll discuss, but the National Economic Council Director Kevin Hassett has suggested he will be unveiling a housing policy plan. So we'll see.
All right. That is NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben. Thank you, Danielle.
Thank you.
At least 40 people have died in a train accident in Spain that left more than 100 injured. Some are still in serious condition. The accident Sunday night involved two high-speed trains traveling in opposite directions. We're joined now by Miguel Macias from Seville in southern Spain, close to where this accident happened. Hi, Miguel.
Hi, Elsa.
So this collision, it happened along the main line that connects Andalusia, where you are, to Madrid, right? Can you just tell us what is the latest as far as we know?
Well, there's still a lot that is unknown, most importantly, the cause of the accident. But the details are devastating. In addition to those who died, dozens of survivors are still in the hospital. Some of them are still fighting for their lives. So sadly, the death toll is not final. The accident happened when a northbound high-speed train operated by a private company, derailed at more than 120 miles per hour. Some of the cars fell into another track and crashed into another train, which was traveling south, exactly the opposite direction, at high speed as well. This last one operated by Renfe, the state-owned train company. But the thing else is that that everyone is talking about in Spain is how strange this accident is.
Strange? Strange in what way?
Strange as in, it is a complete mystery at this time, and it will take days, if not weeks, to find out what happened. Last night, Transport Minister Oscar Puente spoke to the press and was one of the first ones to point out some of the contradictions.
El accidente es tremendamente extraño, es en una recta.
The accident is tremendously strange, Puente said, as the trains were traveling on a straightaway section of the line, which included the north and the southbound tracks. That section of the tracks we just mentioned had been renovated in May 2025. Also, both trains were traveling under the speed limit, so that doesn't seem to be the issue here. IDIO, the operator of the train that derailed, says that their train was inspected just 4 days ago and that it was made very recently in 2022, so top technology. Here's the company's president, Carlos Bertomeu, speaking to the press today. He seems as baffled as the minister when he says that in a straightaway section, and the fact that it was not the first car that derailed, but the last cars of the convoy, he's clear this is a strange accident.
So scary. Well, are there at least some few clues that might help us understand what could have happened?
There are some clues that are beginning to be known. For example, it was the last two cars of the train that derailed that fell onto the parallel track. And 20 seconds is the time that may have taken for the two trains to come into contact. Not nearly enough time for a train at that speed to stop, of course. Mm-hmm. Also, to be cautious, we don't know if there's any connection here. But in the past year, Adif, which is the company that handles maintenance of all train tracks in Spain, had pointed at problems in areas that include the place where the accident happened on Sunday. But those problems had been resolved.
Mm. Well, this train line, which, as I mentioned, connects Seville and Madrid, it was the first high-speed connection built in Spain. Is that correct?
Yes, indeed. It was 1992. The World Expo in Seville was the reason for bringing high-speed rail to Spain. Slowly, other cities in the south were connected to Madrid as well, but all of those individual lines merge into a single one that goes north, and that connection happens in the region of Córdoba, where the accident took place. It's worth noting, too, that for decades, high-speed in Spain was the monopoly of Renfe, the state-owned company. But in 2019, private operators were allowed into the market. So high-speed train traffic from Andalusia to Madrid has increased substantially in the past decade.
That is NPR's Miguel Macias in Seville, Spain. Thank you so much, Miguel.
Thank you.
Scientists have documented a lot of animals that use tools, like chimps, sea otters, and octopi, to name a few. NPR's Nate Rott reports a new animal has joined that list, a 13-year-old Swiss brown cow named Veronica.
Before we meet Veronica, it's worth explaining how she came to scientists' attention. Elise Auersperg, a cognitive biologist at the University of Veterinary Medicine, Vienna, wrote a book about animal innovations that published last year. And after that, she started getting all sorts of videos from people
telling me that they think that their animal was using a tool.
For example,
cats using Amazon boxes as tools for housing. There were videos of dogs using sticks to brush their teeth.
Or maybe they were just chewing, which kind of illustrates the bigger problem.
Not even the scientists are really clear about what tool use really is.
Auersperg has a very technical definition, but she says the simplest way to understand it is to think of Baloo the bear from The Jungle Book when he starts scratching his back on a tree.
That's delicious. Oh.
But at some point, it becomes so enjoyable that Baloo grabs the tree and pulls it out and starts going after body regions that Baloo wouldn't have otherwise reached. And this is the point where the behavior switches from just object-oriented behavior to embodied tool use.
Which brings us to Veronica, an itchy cow living in the Austrian countryside. One of the videos Auersperg received was of Veronica using a stick clasped in her mouth to scratch her stomach and back. So she and a colleague went to visit.
And we landed in this beautiful place, which looks like something out of The Sound of Music.
High mountains, green pastures, church bells literally ringing. They took videos like the kind you're hearing now. And almost immediately after Veronica's owner dropped a stick in front of her,
Veronica just rolled out her pink tongue. With the tip of the tongue, she grabbed, like with an index finger, the stick, pulled the tongue back into the mouth,
grasping the stick between her teeth.
And Veronica just turned her head and started scratching her rear end.
Auersperg and her colleague, Antonio Osuna Mascaro, wanted to know how sophisticated this behavior really was. So they started testing her by providing her with a different tool, a broom.
Because a broom has a functional and non-functional end, right? The broom side and the handle side.
And over the course of 70 trials, Osuna Mascaro says Veronica not only used the broom, she used each end for different purposes. The bristly end, she'd scrape vigorously on the top of her body.
Where her skin is hard and thick.
For her belly, udders, and more sensitive areas, she used the handle end more delicately.
Gently poking and pushing. So two completely different techniques.
Osuna Mascaro and Auersperg says their findings published in the journal Current Biology show for the first time that cattle, long derided as dumb, can also use tools.
Is it tool use? I believe the answer is unequivocally yes.
Rob Shoemaker is the president and CEO of the Indianapolis Zoo and the co-author of the book Animal Tool Behavior. And he says this finding is really exciting.
But it is not as unique as the author suggests.
Goats have been found to scratch themselves with sticks, so have water buffalo. Still, he says, it's further proof that animal tool use might be more common than we tend to think. Nate Rott, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 18 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered on this Monday afternoon here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Bemidji Brewing, located at 211 America Avenue in downtown Bemidji. This new year starts with beer infusions and events such as Tropical Escape Week, featuring live music and tiki glassware. More at BemidjiBeer.com. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. And coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE-KBXE news team. The Friends of the Brainerd Public Library have their annual meeting Wednesday, January 21st from 5 to 7 at the library. Learn about the work they did last year and how you can get involved. A light meal will be served. The Grand Rapids Community Diabetes Support Group meets Thursday, January 22nd at 7 p.m. at the YMCA Active Living Center. This month's topic is medication therapy management. Brainerd Nordic Ski Club invites you to the Lumberjack Jaunt, Saturday, January 24th at Northland Arboretum. Choose from skate or classic with distances of 6 or 16 kilometers. A free kids race is also offered. Find more info and register at BrainerdNordicSkiClub.com. Headwaters is our weekday music show connecting current trends to what has come before, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. and 10 p.m. Tune in tomorrow for a conversation with Mary Lucia about her new memoir, What Doesn't Kill Me Makes Me Weirder and Harder to Relate To. And our U.S. sustaining member of KXE KBXE. If you have recently moved or gotten a new credit card, now is a great time to call us and let us update your information. Call 218-326-1234 and ask for Heather. Now we're going to take you back to All Things Considered here on People Powered Radio, KAXE KBXE.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BritBox, dedicated to offering viewers the opportunity to see it differently with British TV. Streaming original series, Jane Austen dramas, Agatha Christie mysteries, and more at BritBox.com. And from Your Part-Time Controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. YPTC.com/NPR. This is NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang. In some ways, not much has changed in Venezuela. After U.S. Special Forces removed Nicolas Maduro from the country, the rest of his regime remains in power. Interim President Delcy Rodriguez was vice president to Maduro, who was himself the hand-picked successor of Hugo Chavez. But if you listen to President Rodriguez calling for foreign investment in Venezuelan oil per U.S. demands, that sounds far removed from the socialist and anti-imperialist politics that Hugo Chavez was known for. So let's revisit how we got here. Javier Corrales is a professor of political science at Amherst College and co-author of Dragon in the Tropics, a book about the legacy of Hugo Chavez. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to go back to 1998 when Hugo Chavez was first elected. Explain how he first comes to power in Venezuela.
Venezuela was a country that was in crisis. It was a democracy, an oil state, and democratic politics became very corrupt, and the country was unable to come out of an economic crisis. So he bursts into the scene first with a coup that failed, but that made him into a folk hero, a populist folk hero who was promising to liberate Venezuelans from politicians and bad economic policies. And then he decides to run democratically, and he became very popular from the very beginning, again, with a discourse that was all politicians are corrupt and inept. And that was his signature movement from the start.
And what would you describe as maybe his most key or most meaningful accomplishments while trying to enact this platform?
Politically, he essentially destroyed the old system. He managed to eliminate all the institutions of checks and balance in his country. He formed an alliance with the military. He created a system where nobody could stop him. So his biggest accomplishment was to become a semi-dictator. Economically, he spent a lot on the poor, but it seems in retrospect that the amount of money that went in didn't compensate for the returns. There was, of course, poverty reduction, but not as significant as you would have expected given how much money went into that process, suggesting that there was a bit of corruption as well.
Okay, so you have just described Chavez's domestic policies or most meaningful domestic policies at the time he was in power, but internationally, how would you characterize U.S.-Venezuela relations under Chavez?
What's so remarkable is that when he came to power, he was not a strong anti-imperialist. One of the things that he does is very early on, he begins to side more closely with Cuba and with Fidel Castro and with Cuban communism. And you start to see him kind of learning significantly from that playbook. So eventually, he's going to become more radical in his discourse.
Exactly. Like, there are examples of Chavez vehemently attacking the U.S. I remember back in 2006, during a speech to the U.N., he called George W. Bush the devil, right? Like, remind us what that was all about.
So he has an opportunity to go to the United Nations, and this is right at the moment when the United States is very aggressively fighting the war on terror after 9/11. So he takes an opportunity at the UN to really vilify President Bush.
Ayer estuvo el diablo aquí.
And pronounce a very aggressive anti-imperialist speech using really terrible name-calling.
El señor presidente de los Estados Unidos, a quien yo llamo el diablo.
But what is so interesting about him is that despite this discourse, he never, never stopped selling oil to the United States.
Yes.
In so many ways, Venezuelan oil under Hugo Chavez was nationalized, but it was always sold to the United States and to the very same president that Hugo Chavez was criticizing. So a lot of the rhetoric was far more extreme than some of the policies themselves.
Yeah. Well, explain what changes, Javier, after Chavez dies in 2013 and Nicolas Maduro takes over. How much do those two leaders share the same worldview at that point?
So Maduro comes in with the idea that he's going to really continue the legacy, but something really major happened. The price of oil drops significantly, number one, and number two, some of the most important economic policies under Chavez begin to show their negative effects. The nationalizations, for example, lead to a lot of scarcity and inflation.
And how does Maduro respond? Does he become even more authoritarian than Chavez?
He becomes more authoritarian. He tries to maintain the same economic policies, and therefore the crisis deepens. With the deepening of the economic crisis, his electoral base shrinks. He begins to lose electoral competitiveness. And rather than introduce correctives, he becomes more and more repressive of the opposition.
Well, Maduro has been removed by the U.S. and Delcy Rodriguez, like I mentioned, who was vice president to Maduro, has taken over. And it's still early, but Javier, so far, do you see Rodriguez's actions as some continuation of the path that Maduro laid out, or is she shifting the trajectory somewhat? What would you say?
It's too early to tell, but what is so incredibly remarkable and historically unprecedented is that when the United States intervenes to remove the troublemakers, they remove them or neutralize them. But what we have seen here is that Maduro is gone, but the Maduro administration has stayed in place. Mm-hmm. Very strange outcome. We don't have a lot of examples of this. It seems that what we're seeing here is something akin to when a corporation conducts a hostile takeover of another corporation. Mm-hmm. You may remove the CEO, but you keep the corporation in place with its core business still intact.
Right.
This is what we're seeing now, but it could change. It may very well be that it's too early to make a determination of whether we're going to see more continuity or rupture.
Well, what about Rodriguez's willingness to solicit foreign investment in Venezuelan oil? How does that strike you?
It may seem odd for a leftist regime to be eager to partner up with the United States. But the truth of the matter is that the Venezuelan regime under Hugo Chavez and Maduro had been partnering up with many international actors to deal with its oil industry. Currently, the oil industry is in such dire straits that the regime has realized that they need a lot of help. So I am not that surprised. This is, after all, an extractivist economy, and they need help reconstructing their industry.
Javier Corrales of Amherst College, thank you very much for joining us today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you very much.
This is NPR News.
It is 529, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team. If you or someone you know is living with Parkinson's disease, there is a support group the first Tuesday of every month at 1 p.m. in the meeting room at Central Square Mall in Grand Rapids. And don't forget to tune in to On the River tonight with your volunteer host, DJ the DJ.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report. 5 years of maternal mortality data in Minnesota shows that 95% of maternal deaths occurring in the state were preventable. The Minnesota Department of Health released its report last week examining deaths between 2017 and 2021. Based on the data from the Maternal Mortality Review Committee, the state's 2021 pregnancy-related mortality ratio was about 34 deaths per 100,000 live births. This is slightly above the national average. Most maternal deaths occurred after childbirth, a trend consistent with national findings. The top five leading causes of death were mental health conditions, including substance use disorders, injury, infection, loss of blood, and diseases of the heart muscle. The report highlights stark racial disparities impacting American Indian and Black parents in Minnesota. The maternal death rate was over 12 times higher than the state rate among American Indians. It was more than two times higher for Black parents. Dr. Brooke Cunningham, the Minnesota Commissioner of Health, says these findings are deeply troubling. The report calls for officials to address a lack of access to care, disconnected care, and a lack of follow-up. The report says there is also a need for additional emotional, physical, and mental health supports before and after pregnancy. An Aiken County man is free after 26 years behind bars. 63-year-old Brian Pippett was released from prison earlier this month. His sentence was commuted by the Minnesota Pardon Board in September. Commutation is a reduction in sentencing, whereas exoneration is a reversal of a guilty sentence. Pippett was convicted of first-degree murder in 2001. He was accused of being part of the 1998 killing of Evelyn Malin, a beloved 84-year-old McGregor storekeeper. The Minnesota Clemency Review Commission recommended the commutation in April, emphasizing there was compelling proof of Pippett's innocence. In 2024, the Attorney General's office recommended Pippett be exonerated based on the insurmountable, reasonable doubt of his guilt. The Brainerd Dispatch reports Pippett will continue to fight to clear his name. A new program aimed at improving medical response times in rural areas launched in northern St. Louis County on Monday. Sprint Medic is a pilot program funded through the Rural Emergency Medical Services Aid Package approved by the state legislature in 2024. Paramedics from the Virginia Fire Department will serve as Sprint Medics. One will be positioned in the Tower area and the other in the Cook, Orr, and Boys Fort area. Each Sprint Medic will drive an SUV equipped with advanced life support equipment, such as cardiac monitors, ventilators, and certain medications. Their role will be to roam the service area, ready to respond to emergency calls immediately, while the partnering primary ambulance service travels to the scene in an ambulance. The Sprint Medic also would be able to climb into the responding ambulance to continue providing care. In a news release, Virginia's Deputy Fire Chief Eric Johnson says the department's participation in the program will not affect city services and all costs are covered by the state. A total of $2.7 million was allocated to fund the Sprint Medic pilot program through June of 2027. The DNR is moving forward with plans to reduce the statewide walleye possession limit from 6 to 4. If approved, the move would mark the first update to the limit since 1956. The agency has thrown around the idea for years and gathered feedback on it last summer. The 4-fish limit would go into effect March 1, 2027. The current limit of only one walleye over 20 inches would remain in place. The formal comment period for the proposed rule change is open until March 5th. Find more details on the change and how to comment at KAXE.org. Two of Minnesota's top college teams will square off in the annual U.S. Hockey Hall of Fame Museum Women's Face-Off Classic at Yanmar Arena in Grand Rapids. The game is set for Saturday, January 31st, and will feature Minnesota State University and Bemidji State University. The Beavers and Mavericks will battle for the Hall of Fame Game Trophy, which will be presented by Babbitt native Buzz Schneider, a member of the 1980 U.S. men's Olympic hockey gold medal winning team. A portion of the proceeds will go toward the Foster Hope Scholarship Fund, a Grand Rapids-based charity awarding scholarships to local foster children. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is sponsored by Woodland Bank.
with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River, dedicated to serving the financial needs of the community and their customers. More info at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fidelity Investments. A dedicated advisor can help build a comprehensive wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. And from the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang. President Trump once insisted he had, quote, nothing to do with Project 2025. That's the right-wing policy plan that became a flashpoint during the presidential campaign. The Democrats turned the 900-page conservative blueprint organized by the Heritage Foundation to remake the government into a political boogeyman. A year later, many of Project 2025's policies have been implemented, from cracking down on immigration to dismantling the Department of Education. NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez has this story.
Concerns started off somewhat quietly, but really caught fire when actress Taraji P. Henson singled out Project 2025 while hosting the BET Awards.
Pay attention. It's not a secret. Look it up. They are attacking our most vulnerable citizens. The Project 2025 plan is not a game.
Trump tried to dismiss the hysteria, calling the ideas ridiculous and claiming he did not know who was behind it. But when it was clear the firestorm would not go away, Trump went on the attack against his own allies who wrote the playbook.
No, they're a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
Chris LaCivita, a senior advisor to the Trump campaign, tore into the organizers of Project 2025 at an event hosted by CNN and Politico during the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee. Yet days after winning, Trump tapped Russell Vogt, an architect of Project 2025, to lead his budget office, considered the nerve center of the White House. And other contributors followed. Trump soon unleashed a flurry of orders reshaping the government, many of which were outlined in Project 2025.
As of today, it will henceforth be the official policy of the United States government that there are only two genders, male and female.
He ended diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. He launched massive immigration enforcement and took the first steps to overhaul the federal workforce.
A lot of the policies from day one that the administration has adopted are right out of Project 2025.
Rob Bonta, the Attorney General of California, says Project 2025 defined Trump's first year back in office. And he, like other attorney generals across the country, used Project 2025 as a roadmap to prepare legal challenges against the administration.
The existence of Project 2025 was the Trump administration telling us exactly what they were going to do and sending it to us in writing. The 23 Democratic attorneys general across the nation, we read Project 2025, we reviewed it, we gathered and prepared a response for every potential action in it, should that action be taken.
The White House dismissed concerns about Project 2025, calling them irrelevant theories from Beltway insiders. Abigail Jackson, a spokeswoman for the White House, said Trump is focused on implementing the agenda he campaigned on, lowering gas prices, accelerating economic growth, and securing the border. Paul Danz, the director of Project 2025, says he never took the attacks personally, which he chalked up to political calculus.
You know, I believe the proof's in the pudding. Every day that President Trump rolls out another Project 2025 item is really an endorsement of our work, myself, and the work of thousands of patriots who came together.
Danz, who served in the first Trump administration, is now highlighting that work in a run for the Senate. And he sees the real vindication and the shape the administration is taking.
It was the rollout that, you know, you were seeing Project 2025 come to life, you know, maybe like an animator might see a sketchbook come to this big screen.
Trump did eventually acknowledge Project 2025. During the shutdown last fall, while Trump threatened to dismantle federal agencies, Trump gloated about meeting with Russ Vought of, quote, Project 2025 fame. Franco Ordonez, NPR News.
Every week, hundreds of millions of people turn to ChatGPT for questions about health. That's according to OpenAI. The company now has a platform specifically dedicated to helping people with their health needs. Patients and doctors say it's one example of the way AI is changing the practice of medicine. NPR's Katia Riddle reports from Portland, Oregon.
It's been 4 years since Burt Rosen was diagnosed with cancer.
I have two primary cancers, so I like to joke I went to the cancer store and buy one, get one free day.
Rosen is sitting in his office. He works in marketing for a local college. He's 60. He looks like any other working guy you might see downtown, wearing the business casual uniform. It's not obvious he has cancer.
I have one that's fairly common, which is called renal clear cell carcinoma or a kidney cancer. And the other one, which is much less common, is called a pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor.
He's working closely with his doctors, but he says his secret weapon to managing treatment side effects and keeping as stable as possible, information and knowledge about his disease with an AI platform called My Doctor Friend. Recently, he's also been using the new OpenAI platform, ChatGPT Health. Here's a recent example he brought to AI.
I said every time I sleep, whether it's a nap or overnight, I wake up with a bad headache, almost migraine level, and a lot of nausea.
In response, he says AI asked him what position he slept in. It suggested that lying flat could allow pressure to build up in his head.
So it's not surprising you wake up with a headache, and then a nausea can actually be a symptom of a migraine headache.
Try sleeping with two pillows, AI suggested. No more headaches. With people rapidly incorporating AI into their healthcare, there are many unanswered questions. How will patients protect their privacy? How can they avoid misinformation? Will there be a great divide between patients who are technically savvy and those who aren't?
I actually think it's going to be a really good thing for healthcare.
Dr. Robert Watcher is chair of the Department of Medicine at University of California, San Francisco. He's just written a book called A Giant Leap: How AI is Transforming Healthcare and What That Means for Our Future. Watcher acknowledges all the questions around AI in medicine, but he says for many doctors, the changes have already been profound, like a tool that automatically transcribes conversations with patients.
Doctors now have access to what's called an AI scribe. So if you come in and see me in the office, I'm going to put a phone down on the desk and ask your permission, and we will have a conversation. I will be looking you in the eye. 2 years ago, I would have been sitting there pecking away on my computer.
Another change. He says he and his colleagues have widely adopted a program called Open Evidence, kind of a ChatGPT for doctors, that has put invaluable medical information at their fingertips. Watcher stresses that AI cannot be trusted without human oversight. Recently, he saw AI suggest someone take ivermectin to treat testicular cancer.
It probably wouldn't hurt you, but what would hurt you is you not getting appropriate treatment for your cancer that's totally treatable. So, the capacity for badness here is pretty high.
Still, Watcher says the benefits outweigh these kinds of hazards. That's in part because he says there is so much room for improvement in medicine and healthcare.
Like, if you ask me, what do you think about AI in general? I'm worried about what it does to our politics. I'm, worried about deep fakes. I'm worried about jobs. You know, all those things are very real. It's just in the corner of the world that I work in, I just see a system that is falling apart.
A system, he says, that desperately needs help from new technology. Even still, says Watcher, there's two things in American healthcare that AI cannot solve. That's how to insure people and how to pay for their care. Only humans can fix those problems. Katia Riddle, NPR News, Portland, Oregon.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Young people involved in scouting famously earn badges for things like fishing, music, and even nuclear science. It takes 21 merit badges to become an Eagle Scout. That's scouting's top rank. And as St. Louis Public Radio's Lucretia Wembley reports, one Eagle Scout in Missouri hit that goal and then proceeded to collect every other badge on offer.
Scouting America's Court of Honor ceremony formally recognizes scouts for their achievements. And on this day, it's being held for 18-year-old John Hayes. It begins with a color guard. Scouts from Missouri's Great Rivers Council, dressed in tan and green uniforms, march in holding flags of the United States and the city of Lake Ozark.
Color guard, attention, forward march.
That's followed by the Pledge of Allegiance. And Master of Ceremonies John Detzel talks about the importance of the Scout Law as he reads from an old Scout handbook.
Here's my favorite ones. A Scout is trustworthy.
As he continues reciting the law, a beaming Hayes wearing a sash full of badges stands nearby. Later, he talks about his merit badge journey.
It all started back in Cub Scouts. I didn't really get the passion to get all merit, the merit badge because I didn't know about merit badges and Scouts. But I had an amazing den chief, Dave Weaver. He ignited my passion for scouting in a very strong way. I started to love every bit of it.
It didn't take long for Hayes, then an 11-year-old new member of Troop 21, to set a lofty goal.
Did my first merit badge. Thought it was pretty cool.
That one was for space exploration.
Did my second merit badge. I was like, I want to do every single one of these.
And that was a big dream. The number of merit badges has grown over the years from just 14 in the early 1900s when scouting began to more than 100 by the time Hayes began collecting them. Amanda Hayes says scouting gave her son opportunities to travel the world and learn some valuable life skills, like how to provide first aid. She also made a deal with him since there can be out-of-pocket costs for badges. She told him if he saved his money and paid his own merit badges, she'd handle everything else.
And he did that. He's paid for every single merit badge he did. I said, I'll cover the gas and my time. You cover all your merit badges.
And out of the 140, Hayes has a favorite.
Climbing was my favorite one. At the Lake Ozark Sky Reservation, I took the climbing ridge like 7 to 10 times, somewhere around there, which just kept going back to do it. I loved it so much.
And the last badge he earned was for bugling. John Fapsitz, scout executive for the Great Rivers Council, says earning the merits does require a lot of time and energy, but it's worth it.
So it's an introduction again to those potential careers, hobbies, things to interest a kid on what they want to do with the rest of their life.
And Hayes has already made a decision about careers. He has a student pilot license and started flying airplanes a year ago. He wants to be a professional pilot just like his grandfather, who is an aviation merit badge counselor. And he has a bit of advice for younger scouts.
Keep pushing yourself. Try harder and harder at things. It's good to fail, of course. That's a big thing with scouts, because when you fail, you learn. And be a good person. I'm sad that it's always all over, but I mean, it's good to have it done.
Now, John Hayes joins a special group of just over 600 scouts who earned as many merit badges as they could. For NPR News, I'm Lucretia Wembley in Lake Ozark, Missouri.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:48, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from the Sanford Bemidji Orthopedics and Sports Medicine Center, specializing in total joint repair. More at sanfordhealth.org. Northland Arboretum in Baxter offers forest ice skating during daylight hours when conditions permit. Explore a gently winding trail through the woods with light elevation changes. Limited skate sizes are available to rent on a first-come, first-served basis. They are still looking for donations of kids' and men's sizes of skates. The exhibit, Minwa Chemowinnan, Good Stories, is now open at the Watermark Arts Center in Bemidji. The exhibit highlights community members who have served the Natahwash community for many years. A reception for the exhibit will be Saturday, February 14th, from 3 to 5. North Central Small Business Development Center invites current and aspiring small business owners to the Entrepreneurs on Tap Learning Series, Wednesdays at Last Turn Brew Pub in Brainerd at 5 p.m. There's a different topic each month now through May. Find a full schedule at northcentralsbdc.com. On the River is our volunteer-hosted mix of folk, rock, jazz, blues, and world music on KAXE 7 days a week. Trained community members choose the music weekdays at 1 and 7, plus Saturdays at 4 and Sundays at 1. Big thanks to our dedicated volunteers. And we receive support from Hug Hydronics, committed to making in-floor heating simple, providing in-floor heating solutions for both commercial and residential. More information at hughydronics.com. And don't forget, you can visit our website, kaxe.org, for the latest Up North report, set list, bright spot, and area voices. Now we'll take you back to All Things Considered.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang. Delegates from Vietnam's Communist Party are meeting this week in Hanoi to formally choose the country's leadership and chart its economic future for the next 5 years. The current General Secretary, Tô Lâm, is expected to keep his post and seek that of president as well, a powerful and controversial dual role similar to that of Xi Jinping in neighboring China. NPR's former Hanoi correspondent Michael Sullivan reports.
Tô Lâm is a career cop who made his mark as Minister of Public Security, specifically as chief enforcer of the so-called Blazing Furnace anti-corruption campaign that began in 2016. He ruthlessly rooted out corruption at all levels, sidelining potential political rivals as well. In 2024, both Vietnam's president and the head of the National Assembly were snared in the anti-corruption drive and forced to resign. Tô Lâm became president, then assumed the top job as party chief just a few weeks later after the death of General Secretary Nguyen Phu Trong. Analysts say the economic reforms Tô Lâm has initiated since have borne fruit. Despite global turbulence, Vietnam's delicate balancing act between the U.S. and China, and Trump's tariffs.
He actually has quite a good year in terms of economic performance. Despite the tariff and despite all of those uncertainties, Vietnam's exports still grow 14% year on year. GDP grow 8%, I think, one of the highest in the world at this moment.
That's Nguyen Khắc Giang, a visiting fellow at the Yusof Ishak think tank in Singapore.
A lot of technology companies put a lot of money into Vietnam and promise to do so as well in the next few years. So I think Tô Lâm feel quite confident going to the Congress, saying that actually if you put me 5 more years, I can make it even better.
Tô Lâm also wants to merge the jobs of general secretary and president, as China's Xi Jinping has done, in part to help hasten his reforms and make good on the party's goal of making Vietnam a high-income developed country within 2 decades.
It's a one-party state. It makes perfect sense. In a modern world, having two leaders sharing that power seems, a bit weird.
Vietnam expert Carl Thayer is professor emeritus at the University of New South Wales. He says it's likely Tô Lâm will get both positions, but won't have the same level of power as Xi Jinping, for one thing.
The Central Committee in Vietnam is much stronger than the Central Committee in China. And then once Xi Jinping made himself essentially president for life, there was a kind of counter-reaction in Vietnam.
With that in mind, Thayer expects a compromise from this Congress, one that gives Tô Lâm both jobs, but allows Vietnam's powerful military more control over security affairs in the one-party state as he pursues his economic agenda. And a one-party state it will remain. Human rights groups accuse Vietnam of cracking down on dissent even harder under Tô Lâm as it pursues the same social contract with its people as neighboring China. You let us run things, and we'll continue to make your lives materially better. Again, analyst Nguyen Khắc Giang.
Many Vietnamese observers put a lot of hope in Tô Lâm as a pragmatic leader, even though he's a career policeman, kind of like a more pragmatic reformer inside a system. And they expect him to carry out the liberal reforms in Vietnam in the way that Vietnamese system would go a little bit more freer than China.
The Congress runs through Sunday. For NPR News, I'm Michael Sullivan in Chiang Rai, Thailand.
Pittsburgh's oldest newspaper is set to shut down in just a few months. According to the Nieman Lab, that would make Pittsburgh the largest city in the country without a real daily newspaper. The move marks a dramatic ending to a labor dispute that led to a three-year-long strike. Reporter Julia Maruca with member station WESA in Pittsburgh spoke with members of the paper's union about what's happening.
Pittsburgh Post-Gazette content editor Helen Fallon has been working part-time at the newspaper for decades. She started as an intern in 1987.
It was always the paper I wanted to work for my entire life. My family got it every day. You know, we read both the Daily News, the Post-Gazette, all through the week, and then the press on Sunday. You know, for my mom just being a high school grad, my dad was an immigrant who just got pulled out of school in eighth grade just to go work. You know, we were a newspaper family. We always read, we watched the news, and, you know, that was the way I have always felt. You learned as much as you could, and then you still participated.
But it might not be there much longer. Post-Gazette workers recently found out from a pre-recorded video at a virtual all-staff meeting that the paper will cease to exist later this year.
Today, I am sharing extremely difficult news. On May 3rd, 2026, after nearly two centuries of operating, the Post-Gazette plans to publish its final edition.
Members of the Newspaper Guild of Pittsburgh were on strike for 3 years after the Block family, who owns the paper, unilaterally changed their employment terms. The union returned to work at the end of last year, after a court decision ordered the owners to return to bargaining. Shortly after the start of January, the U.S. Supreme Court denied the owners' application for a stay in reinstating health care for the workers. Only a few hours later, the Blocks announced the paper would be closing down, citing years of financial losses. Andrew Goldstein is the head of the Post-Gazette's union and covers education at the paper. He says longtime union members are no stranger to threats from ownership.
When they couldn't break us, as we have now proven, they cannot break the Newspaper Guild of Pittsburgh, then they decide to take their ball and go home?
Block Communications Incorporated has owned the Post-Gazette since 1926. The Block family also owns the Blade newspaper in Toledo, Ohio, along with several other holdings in TV and broadband. The company did not respond to a request for comment. Even with the conflicts with ownership, Goldstein says the prospect of losing the paper altogether is harrowing.
Not just the fact that we, you know, may very soon lose, you know, close to 200 jobs, but the fact that, you know, the Post-Gazette is something that gives Pittsburgh its identity as much as, you know, the Steelers or Heinz.
Studies have shown that when newspapers close down in a region, civic engagement decreases and government spending increases. Fallon fears that if the Post-Gazette goes away, residents of Pittsburgh and the surrounding municipalities risk becoming less informed.
I really worry that people will become discouraged. They won't vote. They won't participate. They won't help each other. You know, and it's what you have to have. You don't know about these things unless there is a good media source and people read it.
Pittsburgh area news outlets are already discussing stepping into the void left by the Post-Gazette. And Goldstein says he and his colleagues at the paper have been in near-constant meetings, trying to chart a path forward. Goldstein points out that other news outlets have seen success going from for-profit to non-profit with the help of philanthropic funding. He thinks whatever the path forward for the Post-Gazette is, it will likely look a bit different from the print newspaper that exists today.
Maybe it won't be exactly the same size or look exactly the same. But what I want to see is something, if I dare say, better.
So close to the closure announcement, that future isn't clear just yet. But Goldstein says the Post-Gazette's journalists don't plan to give up easy. For NPR News, I'm Julia Maruca in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Progressive Insurance. Building a career is possible at Progressive Insurance. Now offering virtual and hybrid employment opportunities with pathways for advancement. Learn more at careers.progressive.com. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. We receive support from ICTV. ICTV connects, informs, and empowers the community through diverse media. Learn more at watchictv.org. Beltrami Soil and Water Conservation District's annual tree sale is going on now. Young tree and shrub seedlings come in bundles of 25, plus native wildflower and grass mixes are available. Order early for the best selection.